Hi, my name is Nijay Gupta. I teach New Testament at Northern Seminary. My wife is Amy. I have three kids, and I love reading books, coffee, and Asian food.
Dr. Nijay Gupta. Nijay, good to see you, my friend.
Hi, David. Good to see you.
I wish everybody could see me. This is just an audio broadcast. I'm wearing this cool shirt. You're wearing a cool shirt. You're up there in Portland, and we're going to have a great conversation about your new book entitled 15 New Testament Words of Life, A New Testament Theology for Real Life. Great book. Great book. Thanks for making it available and writing this thing. Whose idea was it?
Well, you know, it really came out of, David, my teaching in the classroom with students, mostly seminary students, and they're always asking the so what question. These students are really sharp. And, you know, we don't study the Bible in a vacuum. We study the Bible in the midst of real life. People are having friends who are sick, you know, going through relationship problems, money problems, also successes and great things like promotions at work. And I'm excited that students are sometimes asking questions, how does the Bible relate to all these things going on around me? When we're studying the Bible, we're not just jumping into a time machine going back 2,000 years, even though it's kind of fun to think about history. We're, from a Christian perspective, we're actually engaging with the Word of Life. So I wrote this to say, you have all these big words in the New Testament, righteousness, holiness, grace, peace, joy, love. And sometimes this turns into Christianese. Right? Righteousness, I actually say in the book, you would never see a job ad looking for a shift manager at McDonald's must be righteous. But the word righteous in its original form, as you know, David, doesn't mean holy. It doesn't mean religious. It means good and honest. Mm-hmm. Someone that we can trust in this job. And so really part of this book is breaking down Christianese and saying, what does these words, these big words mean in the Bible? And then what do they mean for real life today? It's pretty simple.
Yeah. So where did the number 15 come from? Was that on purpose? Is there a gematria related to it or something? Mysticism, some sort of Jewish mysticism? Where did the 15 come from?
It is a nice round number, but actually the original title for the book was Words of Life. That was the way I had drawn up the contract. And what I wanted to do is choose a bunch of words. I didn't come up with the number 15, but I just happened upon that. And then I wanted to tie each word to a book of the New Testament so you could have some traction with looking at, for example, righteousness in Matthew or forgiveness in Luke. And it just happened that as I was looking at key texts and key words, it ended up being 15. And the publishers on even said, there's something nice about just having a number to it, 15 New Testament, kind of a roundness to it. So they came up with the title. I like it.
Yeah, and the cover art we were talking about earlier is beautiful. You know, a lot of New Testament theologies are kind of written for the academic and to talk about history and how these ideas developed and such. And you do a little bit of that in the book, but by and large, you are focused in upon the fact that these are words for life. And these are ideas and teachings that are given from heaven to earth for us who are living in the Christian life and going through sometimes some really bad stuff or some really good stuff. And trying to make sense of it. So I love the fact that you've done this New Testament for life kind of idea.
There are a lot of New Testament theology books out there that are 1,000 pages, 1,500 pages, 800 pages. There are some really good ones. You and I, you know, are fans of people like N.T. Wright and Jimmy Dunn, and people have done some really fantastic work in that area. But a couple things really motivated this book. One is I want to write something short. Because we can spend all this time in this esoteric academic speak and it not really touch down and be accessible to people in churches, pastors, people with busy lives. The second thing is a lot of New Testament theology stays in the abstract as if the apostles and Jesus only cared about the eschaton. And one thing that kind of struck me in the last couple of years is the fact that Paul, for example, wrote in personal letter form. And personal letters in the ancient world, generally speaking, talked about normal life. You talked about how's your sister doing? Mm-hmm. Send greetings from these people. Can you bring an extra coat with you next time you visit me? I'm cold. You know, Paul's in prison for some of these epistles. He's talking about some of those conditions. Mm. He's talking about fights that happen between people. Euodia and Syntyche are in some kind of, you know, relationship problem, and he's trying to solve that. And so I feel like sometimes we ignore what's right in front of us, that so much of the Bible, so much of the New Testament is directly engaged in what we think of as the mundane, but the mundane is a part of New Testament theology.
And I like that focus, because you understand that Paul's not writing a systematic theology. He's writing pastoral letters, right? He's writing letters in a way. I've always sort of argued that his letters are a critical part of his missionary strategy. At the heart, he's a missionary, and he's planting churches. And in that act, what he ends up doing is he's having people have problems. Churches have questions. He can't be there all the time. He sends delegates, you know, when he can. He tries to revisit when he can, but he can't always do that. The words of the letters are, in a sense, his presence, or can be a substitute for his presence. Let me just go through a few of these and just let everybody know which words, because I think we've mentioned some of them. I don't know if we've mentioned all of them or not. And then I want to ask you a question about which of these words you think are the most misunderstood in the church. So there's the word righteousness, gospel, forgiveness, life, the cross, faith, grace, fellowship, hope, salvation, peace, religion, holiness, love, and witness. All of these critical words. And like you said earlier, you tie most of these words to a book, but you also sort of cross-reference it with other places. Like you said, the word the word righteousness is tied primarily to the book of Matthew, though it's, you know, it's used in other places as well. Is there a word here that you feel like is the most misunderstood in the church?
Yeah. You know this, David, when you're writing a book proposal, you don't know yet what you're going to write.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you haven't written it yet. So it's kind of a guess. It's kind of part guess, part what you've already done, and kind of with the understanding you're going to muddle your way through it and then revise as you go. Mm. And so I pitched this book and I had an idea of what I wanted to do, but I think part of what you're asking is, were you ever surprised by some of the things you learned as you actually got into the research? And I'll tell you, one of them was forgiveness. Mm. Chapter 3 on Luke Acts, the Greek word forgiveness, aphiemi, literally means to release. And another meaning of this word is divorce. Divorce is literally releasing someone from a marriage contract. And often we think of forgiveness as distancing yourself from someone or something. So for example, the example I use in the book is some insurance companies offer first accident forgiveness. If you get into a car accident, they'll just waive it and they won't raise your premiums. We forgive you. You know, they're basically letting you off the hook. Mm-hmm. Even that image of off the hook is you want to get away from the problem,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
As I was reading Luke and Acts, one thing I realized is how relational the word forgiveness is for Luke. Mm. It's not just about wiping your slate clean. You know, you have all this guilt, you have all this red on your ledger. It's not about wiping it clean. I took part of my inspiration from the story of the prodigal son, which is meant to showcase the gospel. And here you have the son do everything to offend the father, takes the money, leaves the family, essentially cuts himself out of the family. And forgiveness for, you know, when that son comes back home, forgiveness isn't, I forgive you, now go away. Forgiveness isn't letting go of him. Forgiveness is actually embracing him. This idea that the father was waiting. Mm-hmm. It's like when you come home late from a flight and someone's waiting up for you, you know, and you wish that they would just went to bed, but they're waiting up because they, and this father is waiting and waiting and waiting because he won't let go of the son. Mm-hmm. And he's crying and he's worrying because he won't let go. And so that gives a different image of God for us instead of the God that just erases the ledger.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that, you know, I think this is from a hymn, the God that will not let go. That is the image of forgiveness. So that was one that really struck me. I'll give you another and then you can dialogue about some of that if you want. But
yeah,
salvation.
But I love that. That's a great image there. The one who, because the word aphiemi does mean to let something go.
Release. Yeah.
To release, right? Yeah. But in a sense, that relational thing means an embrace.
Yeah, he won't let go.
Wow.
And so forgiveness doesn't mean you don't have to change. It doesn't mean you don't have to repent. But there's this sense that, you know, God's not going to give up on you. And the whole point of the relationship is, the whole point of salvation is the relationship with God, mm-hmm. not to be released from guilt or sin only.
Yeah. And you mentioned a moment ago about another.
Yeah, salvation example. Often portrayed in terms of going to heaven, you know, in modern imagery, going to heaven or avoiding hell. So you might remember I opened that chapter with a story about these kids who run away from home. They take a little fishing boat and they want to sail off to this faraway island that they've heard about. And they didn't take provisions with them, supplies, they didn't take enough food, ended up getting shipwrecked on this other random island that's uninhabited. And they're stuck there. It's one of those kind of movie-like stories, even though this is a real story. And sure enough, a commercial vessel goes by and this, you know, this man finds them and rescues them. But in so many stories, the salvation ends there. You sort of drop them off at home and forget about them.
Right.
But this man actually takes them back to their home, but the police were waiting to arrest them because they'd stolen the boat. So this, you know, this sailor pays for their release essentially from that crime, and then he invites them to work on his boat. They're very young men. And I just thought, man, that is so close to the biblical conception of salvation as more than just a one-time act or pronouncement, and includes God adopting us, essentially, investing in us, mentoring, nurturing. It's the whole point of the Messiah being a king, is the people need a leader. And that goes far beyond kind of the altar call salvation messages that I heard growing up.
Yeah. That word salvation is so rich. There's so much texture to it. And I think your chapter well sort of described many of those faces of salvation. Is this book a book about soteriology, about salvation, or is it for you more about church? You mentioned the life thing, but life is, in a sense, salvation. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, when we come, we are made righteous, we are forgiven, we are given life. I mean, so many things here struck me as really soteriologically oriented, to use a big theological term, but really about our life with God, in a sense.
That's exactly right. I like the way you put that, our life with God. I mean, you know, when people ask, is this a book about salvation? It depends on what you mean. If it's this salvation that is waiting for you in some kind of unimaginable distant future, distant place, no, it's not. In fact, quite the opposite. It's about just what it means to live the Christian life in the here and now, filled with the Holy Spirit, led by Christ, you know, life before God and in the world. And I do think of that as salvation.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, we have the Spirit, we have the church, we have the scriptures, even though we're going to experience even more in the future, a more beautiful world in the future. I would say it's about life. Mm. You know, it's when Jesus says, you know, they'll have life to the full. And then he's talking to Lazarus's family, Mary, Martha, and he says, don't you know about the resurrection? And they say, oh, it's going to happen in the future. He says, no, it's happening now with me. That's kind of what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah.
You know, we can experience God's life and vitality and salvation in some very, very powerful, real way now. We do that in communion with God through the scriptures, through the Spirit, in Christian community. But this is really meant to be read as kind of a constant reminder that grace and the presence of God are constantly with us and guiding us to be formed in the image of Christ.
One of the things that you do here, and I'd be interested in your comment on this, is that even though these are New Testament words of life, a lot of them have a rich history in the Old Testament. And some of them have kind of outside the Old Testament realm, they have a very meaningful effect, in a sense, in the Greco-Roman world.
Absolutely.
So as you investigated any of these words from the Old Testament side of things, were there any surprises there?
Yeah, there was one big one. When I was studying hope, you know, I think of hope as this, you know, future, really distant future thing. When the New Testament talks about hope, it's talking about often the return of Christ or, mm-hmm. you know, the new heavens and the new earth. I did a little bit of study of the Old Testament, And there was an interesting situation where in the Psalms in the Old Testament, the Hebrew uses the word hope. But then when you have the Greek translation of the Psalms, which was popular in the time of the apostles, they prefer to translate that as faith. They actually translate the Hebrew word for hope using the Greek word for faith. Why do they do that? Because often they were using the word hope not as 100 years from now, 200 years from now, but actually trusting God into the next minute. If faith is trusting God in this minute, hope is trusting God into the next minute. So I use the analogy of like dancing. I'm not very good at dancing, but let's say you're dancing with a partner.
You look like you'd be a great dancer.
Well, man, you know. I can pull off the image, but you know, let's say you're dancing with a partner. My understanding is you have to anticipate what they're going to do, right? You're going to move knowing they're not going to step on your feet. You know, we saw Cirque du Soleil over spring break.
Oh, that's a live. Fantastic show, isn't it?
And not only are they great athletes, but we really thought they have to have incredible teamwork to not hurt each other, to be there for each other, to catch each other. And actually, hope and faith are very similar in that way. Faith is trusting your partner now. Hope is trusting your partner that when you move, they're going to move. Right?
That you're going to match
There's
that.
There's a symbiosis between faith and hope. And that's really changed how I look at the dynamic nature of Christian life. Right? Hope doesn't have to be this, I'm going to twiddle my thumbs and wait for the end of the world. Hope can also be like, I'm going to give this money away, trusting God for the next minute. I'm going to go on this trip, trusting God for the next minute. It captures hope as something that happens more in real time.
And that word hope, it doesn't occur a lot in the Old Testament, seems to me. I'm trying to remember if it does.
It doesn't occur what we might think of, quote unquote, theologically, right? It's a very common word. I hope this, I hope that. But I would say its richest use appears in the prophets when they're talking about what God's going to do, but also in the Psalms when it's talking about what Eugene Peterson calls a long obedience in the same direction.
Yeah,
right.
I love that statement. Yeah,
it's a great image. And so hope is used a lot in the suffering psalmist. So many of the Psalms are lament. The suffering psalmist trusting God to bring good news in the future, right? Trusting the promises of God. So even though it's not used as a technical term that often in the Old Testament, hope is actually really important to the life of Israel. That was kind of a discovery for me as I did my research.
And very often, again, seems to me as I think back, it's not a real long distance kind of thing. The hope isn't focused in upon the end of the age. Hope is focused in upon what God is going to do the next minute or the next
day.
The next day. You know, year or something like that. So now if the publisher came back to you and said, okay, this book is not quite complete, we need one more word, what would that word be?
That's a great question. Was there anything on the chopping block?
I'm just curious.
You know, I know that people probably will eventually tell me what they think. I wonder if truth would be an obvious one that I didn't put in there. I'm trying to remember how I chose the 15 words.
Yeah.
In a sense, I think I started with 15 books of the New Testament that are kind of main books. So for example, I cluster some of them together like Galatians and Romans and, you know, some of the Johannine epistles.
You got 15 words but 27 books, so you've got to connect.
Yeah, I combined some of them, but I think I started with the books and then I decided what would be appropriate, like Matthew and righteousness or grace in Ephesians. That's, you know, by grace you've been saved through faith, not of your own. I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer, right?
Right.
But I'm sure there are other ones that could have been added. Truth would be one that would be an obvious one.
Yeah, very good. Well, it's a great book. We commend it to all who are listening. 15 New Testament Words of Life, a New Testament Theology for Real Life by Nijay Gupta and published by Zondervan Press. So, Nijay, thanks for being with us today on the Stone Chapel.
My pleasure.
What a great conversation day. I hope you agree. Only 168 hours until the next podcast drops. I can't wait. Subscribe to our podcast. Rate us. Give other people the opportunity to find us. Tell a friend about us as well. Thanks to the Lanier Foundation, Jocelyn Solis, Phil Kagi, and Kathy Capes, who helped make this podcast possible. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Doing the right thing is never the wrong thing. Ted Lasso.